want to welcome alumni back to campus, especially those of you with in the years 2 and 7. I want to also welcome some members of the Board of Trustees, some of the deans, and some of the senior staff who have joined us here, as well as loyal Cornellians, whether they work on campus or off the campus. Thank you for coming. I'm Ann Kenny. I am the Carl A. Kroc University Librarian, and thank you, Kent. You are my absolute favorite Dean of Architecture, Art, and Planning. And it's my job to tee up our keynote speaker and also to welcome you to the opening of the new exhibit, which is a blockbuster. I had the pleasure of touring it with the visiting curator yesterday, and I could not believe how wonderful it was. So before I turn to my introduction, I do have to remind you, if you have anything that walks and talks and moves, especially if it talks, to please stifle it. And in the spirit of the reunion and in the spirit of the exhibit on human imagination, I'm going to start with a couple of questions. By a show of hands, how many of you remember the launching of Sputnik? Okay. How many of you actually saw it in the night sky? How many of you faked seeing it in the night sky? One of our curators in the Division of Rare and Manuscripts, where the Walker's exhibit is being held, remembers Sputnik very clearly. One October night in 1957, Cornell's esteemed former president, Dale Corson, woke up his teenage son, David, so they could go outside and look for Sputnik. He remembers that it looked like a bright star traveling quickly across Ithaca's night sky, and it was clearly visible, so they didn't need a telescope. I remember getting up looking for it as well, and I faked seeing it. Today, David is our History of Science curator, and he has helped stage this exhibition, including being part of the team that hung the Sputnik, a major piece of scientific history from the ceiling of the gallery in Kroc Library. This Sputnik is part of the private library dedicated to the history of human imagination that Jay Walker founded. Although it was never launched into orbit, it's one of the 7 original satellites that the Soviets built in 1957, and it marked the beginning of the space race. By the way, Jay, I don't know whether you know it or not, but the Wikipedia entry for Sputnik notes the presence of your Sputnik in your personal library. So you've really made it. So we come to my third question. We all know Sputnik was the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth. What was the second? Sputnik 2 was launched November 3rd. The American answer to the Sputnik Vanguard disastrously blew up on the launch pad in December 1957, and Jay Walker's Vanguard satellite, which is also on display in the exhibit, was made from the surviving parts of the U.S. satellite. And it wasn't until January 31st, 1958, that the U.S. successfully launched the Explorer. So the Vanguard and Sputnik are just teasers for what is on display in Kroc Library, and I don't want to give away all the surprises. Let's just say we've never had anything quite like it in the library, and trust me, it's definitely worth the walk over to Kroc. I want to thank the library staff who have made this exhibit possible. First, our exhibit's project manager, Jillian Picciarelli, who has devoted months of her time and considerable talent to this project. Catherine Reagan, the Ernie L. Stern Curator of Rare Books and Manuscripts, Aisha Prather, our exhibitions coordinator, and all the rest of the library staff who have worked to make this possible and to make this the first showing, public showing, of this incredible private collection. And of course, I want to thank most of all the Walker family for the opportunity to display these amazing materials here on campus. Both Jay and Eileen went to Cornell, as did both their children, Evan, who's with us today, and Lindsay. And Jay is celebrating his reunion this weekend. Eileen is a member of Cornell's Board of Trustees, helping lead the university into a strong future of engagement and commitment. And we're keeping them in the Ithaca family as well. Eileen's mother, Lois McManus, lives here, and one of the accompanying exhibitions is installed at the Tompkins County Public Library, where Eileen's mother was involved as a volunteer for the Friends of the Library. There you can see a facsimile of the original 1776 Declaration of Independence, which is one of only two known copies made directly from the original. A few other locations on campus, including Mann Library, the Johnson Museum, and the President's Office, are also hosting small exhibitions. So now let me turn to introducing our speaker. Jay Walker is the chairman and curator of TEDMED, which is the world's leading conference on the future of health and medicine. He's one of America's best-known business inventors and entrepreneurs, and he's founded multiple successful startup companies. But once a year, TEDMED hosts a grand gathering where great minds from both inside and outside of medicine come together to meet each other and to talk, in the style of TED Talks, which some of you may have watched online. It's intended to open up creativity and form new connections between, oh, for example, the head of the National Institutes of Health and a four-star general, or a Nobel Prize-winning neurobiologist and an opera singer who has had a double lung transplant. His work at TEDMED makes a very nice connection to the theme of our exhibition, Human Imagination. At the conference, incredibly imaginative minds come together and create new meanings through their interactions, and we think the exhibit does that as well, through the juxtaposition of seemingly disparate objects in the same display cases. So as a final reminder, please join us after this talk for the exhibit opening and reception in 2B Kroc Library. You will go right out the door and head just across the quad to Olin Library. If you need a hand getting there, I understand we have two golf carts at the ready. So again, thank you for coming today, and join me in welcoming Jay.
So before I begin, let me tell you something interesting about Sputnik, just briefly. None of you saw Sputnik, unless you had a telescope. What you actually saw were the booster rockets. When Sputnik was in space, it was trailed by its four booster portions, which were quite large, and they were the things that actually reflected the light from the sun that was visible with the naked eye. So everybody actually saw, who did see it, saw booster rocket stages and did not actually see the Sputnik. So, let me begin with a deceptively simple question. What is imagination? You know, in everyday conversation, we tend to think of imagination in one of three ways. It's either an innate cognitive capacity, sort of like IQ. It's also an inherent function of the brain. For example, when we dream or when we sleep and dream, we sort of imagine things that are unreal. And finally, we speak of imagination as a feature of the personality of somebody, like a character trait. You might say either you're outgoing or you're not, either you're cheerful or you're not, either you're imaginative or you're not. So we tend to use imagination in three different ways colloquially. Today it's actually considered an insult if you say to somebody or say about somebody, he has or she has no imagination. And you might think, well, it's always been an insult. Actually, for a long, long time in history, it was quite the opposite of an insult. And we'll get to that in a little while. But imagination applies to much more than individuals. It applies, actually, to entire cultures. It can even be applied to all of humanity. In fact, I believe that humanity's long climb from the swamp to the stars can be measured as a journey of material progress in one sense, but in another sense, it can be viewed as a journey of the imagination. Now, human beings didn't invent fire, for example, but someone discovered that sparks could create it, and after that, it took an act of imagination to visualize the possibility of creating fire whenever and wherever you want it, and then using that fire as a tool. Different crops would naturally grow here and there on the plains and savannas of Africa, but it took an act of imagination to realize that they could be cultivated, that they could be raised deliberately, not just found randomly, and that humans could change their relationship with the environment from one of passive acceptance to one of active imagination. Imagination undoubtedly drove the person who invented the very first wheel, probably as a toy, and the creation of civilization is in itself a stupendous act of collective imagination. It's made up of an infinite number of acts of individual imagination. It's been said, for example, that human beings are storytelling creatures. What sets us apart from the animal kingdom, at least as far as we know, is not just our ability to make tools or use language. It appears that monkeys make tools or chimps make tools and dolphins certainly have language. What makes us uniquely human is that we tell ourselves stories. We tell ourselves stories to make sense of our own experiences, to make sense of ourselves, and to make sense of the world. So if that's true, then human imagination in the stories we tell ourselves is actually the fountainhead from which the stories we tell ourselves grow. And if that's true, then the attempt to understand imagination is actually an effort to understand the very essence of human nature and, therefore, of human civilization. If human imagination is the primary source, the deep wellspring of art and culture, of science and technology, then the story of art is actually a history of imagination. The story of science is a history of imagination. The stories of culture, philosophy, of war and peace, of medicines and miracles, of engineering and communication are histories of imagination. In that sense, we can say that imagination itself has a history. So in order to understand the history of imagination, which in some sense encompasses everything that human beings have ever dreamed of, wondered at, created, or thought at, we need a frame of reference that is wider and grander and more all-encompassing, perhaps, than any we have imagined before. To coin a phrase, we need a way to imagine imagination. Because it turns out that the history of human imagination includes both the activity itself of imagination in every field of human thought and endeavor, and it also includes the history about how we think about imagination. So today, I have the privilege of inviting you to join me on a quick tour at this lecture and a much better tour at the library of some of the exciting moments, or bright spots, if you will, or unusual, flexes in the curve of the history of human imagination. And to bring this journey to life, I'm going to share some of the treasures and artifacts from my library of the history of human imagination right here from the stage, items that are the basis of the exhibition that opens today. So the library came about because the concept and activity of imagination has personally fascinated me for many years. So if the history of human imagination demands a wider frame of reference, if you will, then a library to sort of house that history requires a very different design. You would have to have a pretty unusual design for a library that actually housed a collection about the history of human imagination. And so I've tried very hard to create an engagement space in the library that inspires the imagination of everyone who visits. So to set the stage for what follows, I'd like to show you a brief 4-minute video. We'll try to get the room dark enough here, showing you the library itself, not the Cornell exhibit. You'll see that hopefully soon. And this 4-minute video is sort of a poem. It has no voice. Was created by award-winning filmmaker and close friend David Hoffman. So if we could dim the lights, we're going to show you a brief video here of what the library looks like. You can roll the movie. Thank you. Thank you. The Library of the History of Human Imagination is part book collection, part art gallery, and part Wunderkammer, the German for a cabinet of wonders, essentially hundreds of artifacts, as you saw, that capture the lightning flash moments of human imagination. So let's get started and see a few together here today. So let's begin with origins. How and when did human imagination come about? I speculate that it's begun as a response to three great mysteries that date all the way back in the human experience. The first is the mystery of the natural world, specifically the night sky, right? That great Milky Way that appears every night. The second is the mystery of the human body, the machine. How does it function? What goes on inside of it? And the third is the mystery of life, but even more so of death. What takes an object that appears alive one second, and suddenly it is dead the next? These are the three great vectors, as I call them, of human imagination. More than 250,000 years ago, and more than a million years ago probably, but certainly Homo sapiens sapien, more than 250 or 200,000 years ago, primitive cave dwellers looked up at the night sky, and they saw the changing panorama of the moon and the stars, and they had to have asked themselves, what are these lights in the sky? Where do they come from? Why do they move? Why do they change? Okay. Why do some of them move differently than others? Those planet things. Likewise, as soon as humanity was able to ask questions and speak, people came to ask the question of what explains our bodies? Why do they grow? Why do they age? Why do they get sick? And why do they sometimes get well? Why do certain foods and herbs help us while others harm us? Remember, if you have no science, you're stuck with imagination to answer those questions. Finally, prehistoric peoples all the way back have always asked, where does life come from and where do we go after we die? All those millennia that have preceded us in the modern age, there was no science to answer any of these questions. And so each one of them required a leap of imagination. The way to explain the unexplainable required the earliest humans to visualize, or at least explain, the invisible, to explain the movement of celestial bodies, as well as the arrival of life and the departures of death. People had to imagine whole complex sets of reasons. Invisible powers must be in control of it all, must have created it all. How else to make sense of the movement of celestial bodies? How else to understand the arrivals and departures of life and death? How else to explain why the body must work the way it does? Thus, I believe human imagination was born out of necessity to explain. And we might even say that human beings were born because only a human being, as far as we know, is capable of imagining answers to things that really cannot be seen. So as I said earlier, the history of human imagination is not just the history of how we use imagination, it's also the story about how we think about it. So today, we revere imagination. It's almost a godlike agency in the modern world. Albert Einstein, certainly one of the greatest theorists that we revere and one of our greatest scientists, said famously, imagination, quote, is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world. In fact, Einstein said that he got the idea for his theory of relativity when he imagined himself riding a beam of light. So, this is where that first great vector has led us of imagination. It's to a relativistic world where light bends and time progresses at different rates depending on the position of the observer. Okay, and ironically, all of that imagination starts in a book this small. Okay, so here is Einstein's first copy, all right, his lecture series, where he is giving a lecture, if you will, on the theory of relativity. And in a handful of pages, right here, in simple text, he lays out, okay, his theory of relativity. No pictures, no illustrations. It's 11 pages long in a little pamphlet. Here is one of the great leaps of human imagination. And yet when we look at it, it doesn't look very imaginative. But it is nonetheless the power of the mind rendered in words in 11 small pages published. Of course, we can see something imagination when we look back about 500 years. But a man named Appianus is trying to explain a very simple problem. And here's the book he publishes. Let's see if I can zoom out here. So when Appianus publishes this book, and he's got to explain a problem. And the problem is that there are stars in the night sky that seem to move in very unpredictable ways. Right? And these stars, of course, are the planets. Now, if you believe that the planets are in perfect circular motion, you've got this problem. And especially if you believe that the Earth is the center of the solar system, you've got planets making pirouettes in the sky when you chart them over time. And so if you're a good scientist in 1540, what do you do? Well, you design an explanation of wheels inside of wheels inside of wheels to explain why planetary motion is so bizarrely unnatural. Of course, if you haven't imagined that the sun is in the center of the solar system and not the Earth, you have no real chance to understand why these things are the way they are. And this book is considered really the most beautiful book of the entire 16th century. It's these spectacular wheels inside of wheels. I can't move it higher here, or I would. Let's see if I can here. And you can see each of these wheels is designed to explain why a different planet is moving in a different direction. Needless to say, the imagination here is totally wrong. However, that's never stopped science in the past. Okay? We all know that most of science is wrong, but it's a process of unfolding discovery. It's a process of imagining yet unknown ways of explaining reality, yet unknown ways of explaining the world that we seem to experience. And so imagination has an integral role in moving science forward, even when it's totally wrong and quite beautiful. So let's move forward. The second great vector of human imagination was the original question that primitive humans had about the mysteries of life and death. This vector leads us straight into the realms of spirituality and the creation of thousands of different religions throughout the history of mankind. In many of these religions, at the very center stands a creator God who is responsible for giving birth to the world. But if today we see imagination as sort of godlike, it wasn't always so. In fact, the opposite is true, as I implied earlier. The word imagination only appears in the King James Bible 20 times in the entire Bible. Most of them sound like this first use in Genesis. Quote, "And God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Not a good start for imagination here. Okay. Now, the Bible, of course, is the central document in the history of Western civilization. So this is not a very good piece of news for those of us that think imagination is a positive thought. Of course, it's fun to see a Bible when we look at it because the Bible takes off when this happens. When a man named Gutenberg basically is very good making clocks and watches and has also seen a few wine presses too many in Germany, decides he can marry several different technologies, and he has imagined a way to print. And so this is a fragment, or a single page, or a leaf, of a Gutenberg Bible right here. So the Gutenberg Bible is printed around 1450 to 55. We're not quite sure. And here you can see, right up close here, the very first book printed in the West using movable type. As most of you probably don't know, printing, like most everything else, was invented in China. In this case, about 150 years earlier, with movable woodblock. But the Chinese didn't invent much of the technology and certainly didn't commercialize it to the success of Gutenberg. So when we see, I'll hold it up here, this, we're seeing the beginning of the unleashing of imagination in the modern age. Of course, we're living at the end of the age of ink on paper, so within most of our lifetimes here, ink on paper will become a small vestige. Of course, books will be different in their way and form, just like they were different when Gutenberg invented it. So we live in this wonderful window where we both have one foot in the past and one foot in a changing future. Ironically, the creation of the printing press was first used to disseminate the orthodoxy of a text that had very little good to say about imagination, as we just heard. And yet that same printing press freed people's minds to learn and study and think for themselves, first about the Bible, and then about everything else. Before Gutenberg, it wasn't just the Hebrew prophets who looked askance at imagination. Imagination was actually highly suspect in the eyes of the ancient Greeks, whom we revere in many ways for what we think was their imagination. For Socrates and for Plato, imagination was all about conjuring up untruths. Imagination was seen as inferior to reason. In fact, imagination was dangerous, okay? Because it could corrupt reason. The Greeks' closest word for imagination, they don't actually have a word for it, was phantasia, roughly translates as fantasia in the English. I don't speak the Greek. But in the Republic, Plato worries about accepting the unreal as real. He also warns against, quote, fantastic and lawless visions. Look at this. This is Plato saying, you're warning against fantastic and lawless visions. It was no accident that Socrates was made to drink hemlock for misleading the youth of Athens. So for the next millennium and a half, imagination was less honored than any obedience to orthodoxy. Not just in religion, but in science too. If you were in science, it was not about imagination for 1,500 years. The third great vector of imagination led to science, the science of medicine, and the healing arts, but it was a long, slow climb. Let me show you the history of medicine. In an early book published in 1493, this is the first illustrated medical book. It's called Akethem. It's published in 1493, and this book happens to be a colored copy. That means it's hand-colored, and here you can see a spectacular page used. The very first diagnostic chart ever published is right here. And the color of your urine is used in this chart to determine what is wrong with you. And that's what's going on in here, since urine color was clearly the most important thing in those times, according to the ancient. But here is the origin of science. So here we can see the astrological symbols. This is the leading medical book of the time, and you can see exactly what's going on. You can tell what's wrong by your astrological signs. So in other words, how the sky looks, how the stars in the sky have a direct representation. Here's the wound man, a very famous image where they showed every possible wound you could have wrong with you. We're not going to spend time on wound man here, but I am going to go to one thing because it's very relevant for a university. This is a spectacular thing. Here is how, for 1,500 years, knowledge was disseminated in medicine. This is the university professor here, and this is an anatomy class. He has never, ever dissected anything in his life, let alone a human. He is the professor. He, of course, would never get his hands dirty. The barber down here is cutting this person open because this is the beginning of anatomy. The students here are paying absolutely no attention. And that is 500 years ago. And the professor is reading from a book that was written by Galen in ancient Rome, and he is droning on, because Galen, of course, dissected animals and never dissected humans either. This is the university tradition writ large 500 years ago. Okay. So, notice I mentioned that the students, of course, weren't paying attention then either. If they had Facebook, they'd be paying even less attention. Why are they paying no attention? Because none of the diagnosis or treatment of the error, 1500, 500, depended on anatomical knowledge. Okay, this was simply a required course that they had to take. The English word imagination dates back really only to the 1400s. Of course, English doesn't date back too much further. It comes from the Latin word imaginatio, which means image. Obviously, other languages had words that meant what we called imagination. Otherwise, the King James Bible wouldn't have been able to translate it from the Hebrew and the Greek. But although Genesis and Plato's Republic saw human imagination as a dangerous evil, it was in the Renaissance that we began to think better of the idea. In Bacon and in Shakespeare, imagination becomes the handmaiden of creative vision. It competes with reason for the first time on an equal footing, but it's not to be trusted. We see this ambivalence in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Shakespeare writes, quote, "The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact." The lunatic, the lover, and the poet. Those are your basic imagination people. But in the next breath, Shakespeare can't help himself. He heaps praise on the thing that makes it possible for him to write plays. Quote, "Imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown. The poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name." So Shakespeare, of course, recognizes that he is using imagination in his wellspring. Nearly two centuries after Shakespeare, imagination is still regarded with suspicion. It was the seductive signpost on the door to illusion and confusion. In the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton writes, quote, "Imagination may range at pleasure till it gets bewildered amidst the labyrinths of an enchanted castle and knows not on which side to turn to extricate itself from the perplexities into which it has so rashly adventured." Here you hear it in the founding of our country, in the Federalist Papers itself. Imagination is being discussed as a danger, as a place to get lost, as an enchanted castle. Look, we're only talking here 250 years ago, and imagination still doesn't have any respect at all. Okay. So, but if intellectuals were still hostile to imagination, practical inventors of the world were busy putting it to work. About 20 years after the Federalist Papers, a French businessman named Jacquard was trying to figure out how to get more customers for his silk looms. Now, the Jacquard loom is one of the great technology leaps forward. It's a weaving machine, essentially. There still are modern Jacquard looms. And the weaving machine uses these punch cards, which these are facsimiles of, for which hooks drop into the card and allow the machine to weave far more complex patterns than had ever been possible before, for far less money and far quicker setup. And so these cards became an idea, a technology idea, that you could have a piece of software, literally, an instruction set that sat and drove a machine. Right? And it's these machines, of course, that later on take over so much of our modern world. But let me show you what happens when Jacquard faces a problem of imagination. He needs people to buy his machine. And he's saying to people, "I have a machine that can weave anything." And people are saying, "What do you mean a machine that can weave anything?" Because a machine that can weave anything, they say, "Well, we don't understand what you mean. We're not buying your silly machine that can weave anything." And so what does he do? He writes a program of 40,000 of these cards. And here's what he weaves. He weaves an entire prayer book in silk. This book has no printing. It is woven in silk. So every piece here that we're seeing, and I'm not touching it with my finger, it just looks like it, is like a scarf woven in silk. And here, this type is a prayer book. And no matter how close I go, you can barely see. He has woven a book. He has imagined that the best way to sell his loom is to weave a prayer book. Why? Because he's imagined that none of the men will buy this loom, but if he gives a prayer book to their wives, woven in silk, their wives will harass them to say, "Why can't you weave me a book at your mill?" And they will have to buy Jacquard looms. And that, of course, is exactly what happens. Can't fool those French. The loom and the punch card, of course, lay the foundation for this card. Of course, it's no different. For those of you that are under the age of 40, this is an IBM punch card. It's a sad thing. Okay, an 80-column card, no less. And you used to punch holes in this card as a way to give instructions to the computer. And when you had a problem, you had to find the hole that was wrong. Imagine how much fun that was. Okay. So here's another irony. Computers have taken over many of the rational functions of human intellect by giving our minds a lever in the intellectual world. Computers, in many ways, have set people free. Free not to do so much of the drudgery tasks, and free to spend time imagining and creating in ways and on a scale never seen before. Obviously, this is just one tiny chapter in a much larger story in the history of human imagination, because part of that larger story is the invention of mathematics. Mathematics are an incredible leap of imagination. Try as you might, you won't see any numbers anywhere in the world. Go look for them. They're not there. We make them up. They are entirely a language of imagination, a way of describing reality. And as one famous essayist put, an unreasonably effective way of describing reality. As we know, mathematics allows people to explain observations in the natural world, from the motion of planets to the distance of ships to the size of subatomic particles. Based on those measurements, mathematics, a purely imaginary art, allow us to create technology and engineering artifacts. It was mathematics that allowed us to align the pyramids 5,000 years ago within 1 inch of polar north. That entire pyramid is perfectly aligned. Mathematics even allow us to rearrange the basic elements of matter, whether it's in a giant collider or in an atomic bomb. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. In the late 1800s, imagination had finally come into its own. No longer a misleader of youth or an unreliable guide, imagination, starting in the 1800s only, was now seen as the power of vision and creation. All rolled into one. Suddenly, imagination mattered. Ralph Waldo Emerson writes, quote, "Whatever appeals to the imagination by transcending the ordinary limits of human ability wonderfully encourages us and liberates us." Think about that. Imagination suddenly becomes the transcendent force in humanity, as opposed to the evil temptress force. The composer Richard Wagner says it in a different way. "One supreme fact which I have discovered." Does that sound like Wagner or what? Okay. "One supreme fact which I have discovered is that it is not willpower, but fantasy imagination that creates. Imagination is the creative force. Imagination creates reality." Now imagine a man steeped in German culture. The German culture, right, is saying imagination is the force. Not willpower, not Sturm und Drang, but imagination. Imagination creates reality. This is, in many ways, the watchword of modern society. If we can imagine it, we can create it. So, imagination suddenly becomes the power to reinterpret everything around us. From Louis Pasteur's germ theory to Darwin's theory of natural selection, human imagination suddenly causes a revolution in how we view ourselves and our world. But the glory of human imagination wasn't just for aristocrats and geniuses. In America, we were coming to see imagination as everyone's birthright. Emerson says, "Imagination is not a talent of some men, but is the health of every man." This is a birthright statement. The practical genius of a new age of inventors is unleashed in both Western Europe, but more so in America. In Boston, a young teacher of the deaf named Alexander Graham Bell performed what Einstein later calls a thought experiment and asks, "What would happen if I could somehow transmit a human voice over a telegraph wire. After a decade of on and off experiments, Bell invents the telephone. By the early 20th century, imagination had not only drawn equal with reason, but in many circles, it surpasses it. For philosophers like Nietzsche, writers like Huxley, and artists like Picasso, imagination is the doorway to a truth that is higher than reason. Plato is rolling over in his grave for sure on that one. For scientists like Einstein and J.S. Haldane, imagination is the entry portal to scientific truth that sometimes confounds reason. Haldane expressed the view that, quote, the universe is not only stranger than we imagine, it is stranger than we can imagine. He's imagined that imagination itself is beyond the human capacity to embrace. And while these scientists were truly imagining a new basis for the physical universe, the early schools of psychoanalysis were imagining a new model of human nature. Freud, Jung, Adler, and the rest performed a tremendous act of imagination by actually creating a metaphysical map of the human mind. Their imaginative map included such previously uncharted territories as the id, the superego, and the collective unconscious. Now, whether you call these ideas fiction or insight, that's not relevant. They opened entirely new realms for human imagination to roam about. In fact, this is a good way to see it. These are Rorschach inkblot tests. What do you see here? Your imagination becomes a window into your not only personality, but to the state of the health of your mind, the state of the capacity of your ability to think. And not only that, whether or not you are an idiot, insane, or a genius is defined by how you imagine these ink blots to reveal some shapes you can recognize. Ink blots. So, it was also in the 20th century that we begin to get powerful fusions of imagination between psychology and literary theory, between comparative anthropology and language, between dream symbolism and logic, between the irrational world of fantasy and the ultra-rational world of modern science. Talk to a physicist about quantum mechanics, and you're not sure whether he's insane or you're insane, but you're sure one of you is not quite all there. So thinkers like Carl Jung and Claude Levi-Strauss and Joseph Campbell, they suggest that the human mind is inherently deeply structured in the shapes and myths and archetype, and that human beings can't help but see the world in mythological terms. The result that they say is that no matter how much rationalism tries to get rid of fairy tale images and thinking in one sphere, they pop right up in another sphere, stronger than ever. So it's no coincidence, they say, that just as soon as you squash the myth of alchemy, which says that you can convert spirit and matter into something else, quantum physics comes along and reveals that mass and energy are interchangeable after all. Just as soon as you banish the philosopher's stone, which was supposed to unify the four elements of earth, fire, wind, and water into one, it reappears as the grand unified field theory over there. And shortly after you stop believing in elves and fairies, which are this invisible, elusive, yet all around us, because, you know, without our knowing it, because they inhabit some strange parallel dimension where elves and fairies live, we get the physicists coming right back telling us that reality and virtual particles pop in and out of existence, and that strange parallel dimensions exist, and wormholes and black holes and brains, and what the hell is going on with those people? Okay, so as we move into the 21st century, whatever else may be right or wrong with the world, human imagination is alive and well. I said earlier that imagination has taken us from the swamps to the stars, and that's literally the case. Because here in my last piece, I'm going to take a map here, a star chart that the astronauts on Apollo 16 took to the moon. You see, there was no GPS for their car on the moon, and they had to drive it around. That's a problem when you're on the moon, because getting lost is a bad idea. And it's guys, so they're not asking for directions, okay? We know they're lost, okay? So the astronauts carried this exact chart here. This was carried to the surface of the moon and back. I'm going to show it to you in a second. And what's amazing about this chart, which is really their map, if you will, on where to go, is that this chart involves constellations. Here it is. This Apollo 11 star chart, Apollo 16 star chart, bearing lunar dust, you know, was used by me on the moon. But look here. These are all the constellations. In other words, the astronauts are guiding the car on the moon by looking at the constellations invented way back in the, by the Greeks, of star patterns, of imaginary things and beings in the sky, so that they wouldn't get lost on the surface of the moon. So I submit that the history of human imagination is the secret theme of the story of our species on this planet. And I say that if imagination has a history, which I believe I've made a reasonable case for, then it also has a future. So this great university and this exhibition are a fitting place to ask, what is the future of human imagination? Where might this incredible adventure lead us next? In the future, it's not only possible, but it's likely that we will see imagination cultivated through real training, through real experiment, through real intense belief that we can teach it and we can make it real. There's currently no imagination 101 or 201 or 401, but there ought to be, right? Because there's no question that kids in our society exhibit extraordinary imagination, but by the time they're done with middle school, most of it seems to be gone. And by the time they're graduate students, you're in trouble if you've got too much of it. So, let's allow our imaginations to soar for a moment. What if Socrates was right and the human unconscious actually had access to all knowledge? What if Freud was right that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious? We've all remembered the story of the German chemist who dreamed of a snake seizing its own tail in its mouth and rolling around like a wheel and woke up where he understood that he had thought of how the chemistry of a ring would be done. It's possible that someday, as brain scanning technology gets better and better, we might be able to record our dreams and vastly accelerate both our own imaginative vistas as well as our scientific and our artistic skill. No one can really say. But two things we know for sure. First, if imagination has a history and a future, then there's no better place to explore them than right here at Cornell University. In the very real sense, Cornell itself, like every great university, is a library of the history of human imagination. We just don't think of it that way, typically. Here we teach the history of human imagination in all of its many forms to young people whose imaginations will shape the future of our world. And there is a second thing we know for sure. America is preeminently the country of the imagination, because it has always been the country about the future. It is the country where we often say that our future is limited only by our imaginations. In that case, based on the people and the values of this institution, and based on the soaring nature of imagination itself, I believe our future has no limits at all. Thank you very much.